Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 200, celebrating Tsongkhapa.
Very happy, especially also to talk about Tsongkhapa. To me, this is kind of a year of Tsongkhapa, because this is the 600th anniversary this year of his leaving of the coarse body in 1419, which is a very inspiring time. I never say death, but. But in a way, it is. But people like this don't die, actually. Actually, nobody dies. That's the lesson of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Nobody gets to die. Not a single person. Nobody in this room will even get to die. But I always like to say when I give a talk on the Tibetan so-called Book of the Dead, nobody gets out of here a dead. Meaning the consequences of one's life and actions and thoughts and everything go on forever, and therefore that they be always good and always a little bit better and not a little bit worse is always really important, because their consequence goes on and on. That's the way it is. So I thought I would start, just to be a little dramatic, with a description in Kedrup. Kedrup Jay was a great disciple of Tsongkhapa, one of his two foremost disciples. He was the second leader of the order. He wrote the first biography of Tsongkhapa. His description of Tsongkhapa's passing in 1419, right after the winter solstice. The holiday is still observed by Tibetans, called Ganden Ngamche, sort of candle lighting kind of, it's like a Hanukkah. It's a Tibetan Hanukkah, because it always occurs around Christmas, and it always involves candle lighting. You know, and if you have children, if you're a Buddhist in America and you have children who have schoolmates who are Christian or Jewish, then they want something to do. And luckily we have Tsongkhapa's passing day. So I'm just going to read the description, a rough translation of it that I made many years ago, actually. And a graduate student, my last graduate student, is working on it, and he's writing a biography of Tsongkhapa. Also, another auspicious thing, Thubten Jinpa. I don't know if he ever came here and gave a talk, but Geshe Thubten Jinpa, Dr. Geshe Thubten Jinpa, he has written a wonderful biography of Tsongkhapa that will be published by Shambhala very soon. He sent me the manuscript asking for my criticism, but I didn't really give it, so he wouldn't have liked it. Although actually I basically liked it, but one always has a few of this. As the Zen master here in San Francisco famously said, Suzuki Roshi, oh yes, everything is perfect, and there's always a little room for improvement. So now Kedrup says now, when Tsongkhapa, he realized the time was coming in 1419, he was 62 years of age. He'd had a very serious bout and close call with the passing away about 8-10 years earlier in 1613 or so. And that they had averted that, which was really lucky, because he wrote some wonderful teachings and books after that in those final 6 years. But they realized the time had come. He realized it. And then he went back to Ganden Monastery. He'd been traveling somewhere. And I'm just reading this. He then returned to his own room at Ganden, sat down on his meditation carpet, and said, "Now we have arrived at our own independent monastery, and my mind is at ease. During the latter, end quote, during the later watch of that very same night, his health began to decline rapidly. On the morrow, all the monks devoted themselves to prayers for his continued health. Throughout the next day, he reported experiencing pain in all parts of his body, but after that he felt a little better for several days. To his great disciples, such as the Kapjuba, Rinchen Gyal, Tsenpa, etc., he gave last instructions briefly, as he had instructed them extensively in the past, giving on this occasion only short admonitions, such as, quote, meditate the spirit of enlightenment in this way, unquote, and so forth. Even while his health was failing, he devoted himself to uninterrupted practice of the self-creation yogas, settling himself in undistracted samadhi. Late into the evening of the 20th of the month, he performed the offering worship of Bhagavan Chakrasambhara Mahasukha, Demchok, you know, one of the three or four special chosen deities or patron deities that Tsongkhapa was devoted to, asking Buddha forms, asking for an empty skull cup in which he created the blessings of internal offerings. But some of you may know what that is, just a little bit of tea usually for a Tibetan Lama, but imagined as having all kinds of substances in it. Unquote, he said, I have tasted this nectar 32 times or 16 times, and furthermore, in connection with this offering worship of Mahasukha Sambhara, it depends on the empowerment of this very deity. Thus, I have tasted the nectar by the power of such a circle of deities. So the 32 times would be for the Guhya Samaja, mandala, 16 times a form of, Yamantaka, and then Sambhara, 62 times, you know, a lot of flicking of the inner offering with the finger. End quote. There was no one in his presence who did not understand his words. Some of those in his presence understood by following his gestures that he was also practicing from the point of view of the consecration on the glory of the Bhagavan, Shakyamuni. Furthermore, at that time, the excellence of the patron deity was clearly evinced by numerous signs in the atmosphere, and the Jaya Lama himself, that's what Tsongkhapa is called, Jaya Rinpoche or Jaya Lama, as you probably know, was so enraptured in contemplation that he was not even aware when he was asked how he was. He sat in unmoving concentration the entire length of the night. It is said that the sounds of the recitation of the Vajra mantras filled the atmosphere. In short, those are Om Ahong, that's Om Ahong, the Vajra mantras. In short, the Dharmakaya, clear light of death, and its secret precept were implemented in their full fruition. On the next day, the morning of the 25th, he sat cross-legged in the Vajrasana position. His hands were lying flat together in the gesture of equanimity and remaining in one-pointed trance right after dissolving. And just as the sun arose, he passed through the stages of the three voidnesses. And at that point, he realized the absolute truth, the universal voidness, the clear light of the universal voidness. Thereupon, the normal breath from the nostrils ceased and dissolved within the central channel. And his face, which had become drawn and faded from the pressure of his failing health, suddenly became as radiant as a full moon. His entire body became like a young godling, Devaputra, a young deity, whose body was made of light. There was no trace of sagging or withering or swelling of the flesh, and all his former wrinkles of age, even those as fine as a human hair, were completely vanished. He was suffused in a mass of light dazzling to the eye. Some saw the light of his body as orange gold, some as white gold, and others as the purest gold. His body was like that of a young god of 16 years of age, like the Manjushri Kumarabhuta, eternal youth, with all his ornaments, upon whom he had so long concentrated his inner mind, and so he became like him externally. At that time, those who were suddenly bereft of their protector were shaken with the force of sorrow. Those who were present with no regard for their normal activities were speechless in amazement at this splendid sight. Quote, we are openly beholding the body of pure divinity, they said. Thus, crazed with grief and wonder, they involuntarily gave vent to rude emotions. As he passed from his body, it was suffused thus with a remaining light, as if a human body had been transformed and the body of a youth was glowing there. There is no record of this having ever happened before in the land of snows. There, he's saying that in 1419. There is the story of a great Indian pundit, Gayadhara, whose body miraculously diminished in size at the time of his death and took the form of a youth in full bloom, but there is no record of anything like that in Tibet. Further, from the Buddha's discourse, there are statements to the effect that at the time of attaining the path, or arhatship, an individual who has attained the nectar, his or her faculties become extremely clear, the complexion pure and white, and so forth, and there is a general transformation of the physical. In the case of Ajahn Rinpoche Lama, he realized the clear light of the absolute truth. Through the transformation of the truth body of death, the magical illusion body of the between was resurrected. There is no doubt that there was then the ultimate realization of the exaltation of attainment of the supreme beatific body of bliss in the bardo, that's the Sambhogakaya, of the bar, in the bardo between state. I'm surprised he says that, because Thongkhawa makes a big point that there is no bardo in this kind of a special passing. But it's like a bardo, but it's not ordinary bardo. And the externally apparent metamorphosis of his remaining physical body was but a clear sign of this highest miracle. Furthermore, in the realization of the beatific body in the bardo comes as the ultimate fruit of the mass of causes and conditions cultivated and born in the mind during the attainments of his lifetime. And so on, although there are further stories and reasonings along these lines, still this is not the place to discuss them. And this concludes. So that's the end of the biography then, end of the story. And it's a little tame. This account actually is a little bit tame compared to more esoteric accounts. Because although he became like a 16-year-old, and then he became like Obi-Wan, you know, in the Star Wars. No, and they actually saw, and then what happened was, they saw, I've never read an account that makes it clear whether what happened with the physical body. I think the physical body stayed and almost mummified itself. It stayed in sitting in clear light, in Tukdam, what they call, and it didn't, you know, fall over or corrupt or anything. But then they all had a vision of him in a magical body, what's called the Maya Deha, the magic body. Some rude translators call it the illusion body. But Maya also means magic in Sanskrit. Like, and you know, we can say in English an illusionist as a magician, and Mayakara is a magician. Gyumaken in Tibetan. So I think it's nicer to say magic body, because magic has a more positive connotation than illusion. So anyway, they saw like his magic body, and then the magic body was in union with a consort, a partner, a female, what they call a jnana mudra, a wisdom partner, kind of divine being. Because, and this is really marvelous about Tsongkhapa's life, this point, because he had, 21 years earlier, he had achieved the ability to go in the what's called among the perfection stages, the stage of self-consecration and the magic body. But in order to do that, it is said you cannot do that in an ordinary human body and stay in the human body, stay associated with the human body, unless you have a partner. And the problem there is that the partner has to be at the same stage as you are. But Tsongkhapa had the ability to do that, and maybe there were some yoginis who were trained around in Tibet in 1398, which was the time he attained that, where he could have done that. But he didn't do it because he had made a big fuss about, you know, 20 years earlier, to renew the Vinaya of the monastics. And he knew that if he resigned his robe and, you know, became a lay person and started doing yoga with a yogini partner, a lot of younger lamas and monks would have like, oh, I can do that, you know, even though they were not able to, and it would have wrecked the whole reform that he did of the monastic order, which he considered which is the foundation of the Buddha Dharma, and he considered it so. And I'll talk later when I get to that that was one of his major deeds, what he considered major deed, was renewing the Vinaya at a time in Tibet when monks were kind of loosey-goosey, you could say, like they are nowadays in like Bhutan and Sikkim and certain parts of Nepal and certain parts of Tibet, where they're sort of monks, you know, when they come and do a ritual, but then they have like some children and grandchildren in the backyard type of thing. And they have the occasional chang, you know, barley beer, things like that. So it was like that. And he did this big renewal. He got together all the Kagyus and the Sakyas and the Kadampas, you know, who were the main ones, main monastic ones at his time. The Nyingmas in his time were not very, they didn't have much monastery. This is not really known, but the Nyingmas didn't have big monasteries really until the time of the fifth Dalai Lama in the 17th century, who built many big monasteries for them. And before that, they basically maintained themselves as lay people, lay traditions. They were great lamas, but they were lay lamas. And they didn't have big monastic colleges. So some people I know who were some ex-monks that I know. I'm also an ex-monk, but I don't make any such excuse. I just was karma of being living in this barbarian Western land and being unable to maintain and unlike being in Dharamsala or in Tibet, it was not so easy to remain that in the 60s. But I know some other ex-monks who try to act like they left being a monk, and they can be a monk and have a partner and so on. They can't, you know, that's not possible.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to a special episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast is number 200 of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Over the past 4 years, Professor Thurman has brought you over 230 podcast episodes drawn from his live teachings in New York City, Menla Retreat, and from his appearances around the globe. This week's episode is drawn from Professor Thurman's recent West Coast trip to San Francisco. We'll include details about that visit and the extended video teaching of this audio recording. We hope you enjoy it, and we'll be releasing the second half of this interview / teaching next week as episode 201 of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Over the past year and a half, Professor Thurman's been sitting down with dear friends of his and people who inspire him to record a series of conversations called the Tibet House U.S. Conversations. Stay tuned for special announcements about the new Tibet House U.S. podcast and episodes within this weekly Bob Thurman Podcast, which will feature those interviews. This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast was sponsored by Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa. To learn more about upcoming programs with Professor Thurman and friends at Menla Retreat, please visit menla.us. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special invites to trips with Professor Thurman around the globe with geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Trips in 2019 include Bhutan. The second half of this week's episode includes a reading of the poetry of Lawrence Ferlinghetti by Gary Gock. Hope you enjoy this special poem celebrating his 100th birthday. And as always, music for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously supplied by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Bob and Gary Gock.
So, okay, so now Tsongkhapa, this time that he lived, he is credited by many people in Tibet, and actually this is not well known in the West, but the Chinese actually did a census in the 80s of Tibetan Buddhism and of the different orders of Tibetan Buddhism, and they made the statement that 93% of Tibetan Buddhists were Gelugpas. But we would never know that in the West because it's everyone acts like everybody's everything, you know, and then the Gelugpas are a minority, actually, practically, in some sense. And everyone else is competing in some way. But actually, in Tibet, the movement, it wasn't really, they weren't really that sectarian, mostly, as they have some of the Westerners get, you know, actually. But they and the latest wave of curricular materials and techniques and art and you know building of temples and monasteries was the wave coming from Tsongkhapa, and then maintained and expanded by the Dalai Lamas, and so in a way everyone was sort of there were just all over thousands of institutions of monasteries were all over the place, and which doesn't mean that those people still. Totally fond of Padmasambhava and Guru Rinpoche, and a lot of the sort of aristocrats and people were Kagyu, and it was sort of back and forth. And actually, one of the great things I appreciated about Jimba's biography, Thupten Jimba's biography of Tsongkhapa that he did, was he shows in great detail with correspondence and letters even translated that Tsongkhapa's main patrons were all Kagyus, and a lot of his education came from Sakyapas. And his original teacher in youth was a Kadampa from the Atisha lineage, a Dromdomba Atisha lineage. But the Kadampa was a very kind of weak at school because the Kadampa had never had any political role. Whereas in the 13th and early part of the 14th century, when the Mongol conquest of China was still functioning and the Mongol Empire was all over the place, the Sakyapas were the big power in Tibet. And then that was broken up in the just around the time Tsongkhapa was born. And then the different, what they called the 13 myriarchies, the 13 different sort of provinces, you could say, of Tibet at that time, including Eastern Tibet, were ruled, most of them were ruled by Kagyupas. And the pattern that we now see still today in the Sakya family, where you have one branch of the family maintains a lay person who is the head of the family and sort of the political leader, and then a nephew will be a monk and not have a progeny, and they'll be the head lama of the Sakya, like Sakya Pandita or like the Sakya Chichen or Chidzin, you know, that you all know about him nowadays. And the Kagyu families and lamas, Pagmo Druba, a bunch of them, they had that similar pattern. Shalupa, and so that was the pattern in Tibet. And therefore, Tsongkhapa's own study and work and all of his big deeds and the patrons and funders of that were mostly not Gelugpas. So it's kind of an interesting historical puzzle as to why he... it is known that the Sakyapas were upset with him because when he created this huge renaissance that he created because of the power of his realization and the lucidity of his teachings and the efficacy of them, that people could really attain something when they studied them. Because of that, there was a huge movement that was generated, and they were a little nicked off that hadn't happened within the sort of structure of the Sakya order, because a lot of his academic teachers were Sakyapa. And the Kagyu guys were sort of very secure. They had the political power. His greatest donor and patron was a Pagmo Druba, Kagyu, called Pagmo Druba. And Densad Till was their great base. And they were very secure, so they didn't mind that he made the thing in terms of an old order that was quite minimal as far as its political power goes. But it became huge because the reason it became huge is therefore nothing to do with any kind of sectarian politics. It only had to do with the fact that his teaching was immensely efficacious. You know, if you really study what he has to say and you think deeply about it, you'll understand something. And similarly in Tantra, they created the institution known as a Tantric College, you know, where some people take a track. There's different tracks. Some go in the Geshe academic thing and some go in the Tantric practitioner thing. And because of starting that institution, then the monks in those big monasteries became very skilled at the rituals and the art forms and the mandalas and everything, making the mandalas of these different main Tantric deities, Buddha forms, because they spent their life doing it. They learned to make those mandalas when they were little, you know. They did not study the philosophical thing, but they had a special kind of like art curriculum. It was like the art school, the Tantric school was, and the meditation school. So far from the reputation that has been dished out around the U.S. and Europe and other places that Gelugpas all had their nose in a musty book, and they were sitting there debating about how many angels dance on the hair of a pin like a medieval European scholastics. There is a bunch of that, but they also totally, you know, intensified Tantric practice and so on. But the point is, in his time, there is this thing where there had been a prediction back from India that the Buddha, the genuine Buddha Dharma would last only 2,000 years from Shakyamuni's time. And that the last 500 years from 2000 to 2500 would be what they call counterfeit Dharma, during which time, you know, people wouldn't really be taking it so much to heart. Monks would be a bit corrupt. They'd be fighting in front of a donor's house like dogs over a bone. they have statements like that back in Indian sutras. And so there is this tradition in the Gelugpa order, and maybe some others in Tibet thought that way, that Tsongkhapa's activity, of course, building on the great activities of the Sakya Pandita, people like Longchen Rabjampa, and Marpa Milarepa. One of his greatest gurus on the esoteric practice was Marpa, actually, Tsongkhapa. And he met Marpa and all these people, actually. It's in his secret biography. And but anyway, he was sort of a culmination of the process from what's called the later spread or later dissemination of Buddhism, beginning with Atisha, who influenced all the schools, not just the Kadampa one, but that different great people had been sort of trying to figure out all this huge mass of Indian texts and philosophies and meditation techniques and things. And he kind of was culminated it all and pulled it all together. Although then there's this tradition that his final teacher was actually Manjushri, which I'll talk about, himself, who used to appear to him in a little space bubble, a kind of little like gold. I was looking at it earlier today at the description, like a sort of sapphire blue, kind of like in the paintings you see like a blue background behind the orange Manjushri with golden lines inside the blue. But the description is that the bubble, he was like in a kind of bubble, and it was like a sapphire. But inside that was the orange Manjushri, and then rainbow light rays radiating out for him. And he would show up. But in the Tibetan thing, you know, unlike our kind of notion of, you know, John of the Cross or some of the Western mystics, where they have a revelation of Jesus or Mary or somebody, and it's just they just blast it out by the vision and the revelation. But in the Tibetan tradition and Indian one, when those kind of beings show up, the Obi-Wan types, it's really boring because they just sit there and start dictating like hundreds of pages of elaborate books and things. And it's like, oh yeah, great vision and a lot of rainbow colors, but I've got to write it all down, you know. they have this sort of cognitive dissonance thing of like dictating a lot of teachings, you know, and those visions, and that's what Jayadamshu was doing. So anyway, so this was the thing. So the time was up in Tsongkhapa's time. That's about 2,000 years. Although in Kalachakra astronomy, they date Buddha around 900 before the Common Era, not in the 6th century. The sort of standard thing is, mid-6th century to late to early 5th century, Buddha's dates. That has been the standard thing from Sri Lankan sources. And then lately, the Western scholars, the European ones, are desperately trying to push Buddha back down into near Ashoka, into the 4th century. You know, they're hoping he'll finally catch up with Jesus, so then he won't be earlier than Jesus. They make a big fuss about. But Tibetans put him back, the Tibetan counting puts him back in the 9th century, which is possible. There's still, people don't really know. Anyway, so that would have made, even Atisha's time would have been the end of the Dharma, really. But anyway, in our usual mid-5th century and 6th century, 2000 would have been the end. So in other words, I'm saying, although there is one kind of prediction that it's Kali Yuga, a dark age, that the Dharma is petering out, on the other hand, in a Mahayana-type, Vimalakirti-type vision, this is definitely all happening by Buddha. We're still in the hands of Shakyamuni. This is Shakyamuni's place. And really, we don't have any excuse if we really begin to see that it's up to us, to do what we want to do. But although human beings basically feel, well, I'll meditate later. First, I have to make $1 billion or something. that everyone has excuses not to really deal with it. I'll control my temper next time, and this time I'm going to get mad so I can win this fight and so on, But that's not understanding that Mahayana view that this. And then, of course, that Mahayana view culminates in the Kalachakra idea that we're evolving towards Shambhala, and that Shakyamuni is Kalachakra, and he the time machine, and this time is a machine. It's a compassion machine, actually. Very unusual vision in spiritual traditions, that time is unfolding out of compassion. It's not just impermanence and scary, like in the Bhagavad Gita, destructive impermanence. Time is the space of experience within which we can become enlightened. Because Buddha is helping us to the max. He has to, because as a bodhisattva, he promised not to be Buddha until we're all Buddha. And then he shattered the being trapped in time. And then our future moments of Buddhahood are present to him. So he didn't break his bodhisattva vow. But then to make them come as fast as possible for us, his compassion is active, if you follow my reasoning. So therefore, we're in the hands of dear old Shakyamuni. And it took me 50 years of study to realize one thing. The word parinirvana, those of you who are Buddhist students, right? How is it always translated by everybody? Final nirvana. And then people, especially scholars, Buddha died, they go on about it. But pari doesn't mean final. It's not a temporal word. Pari means complete or thorough. Yongsu in Tibetan, Yongsu Nyangan Lidewa. So it means thorough nirvana, meaning spreading nirvana everywhere or being every place, because when you get enlightened, you are everywhere. Your dharmakaya is everything. So Buddha, poor Buddha, his dharmakaya is right here on Jewel Street. It has to be. He can't abandon any of us because he has to maximize and optimize the time we take from being whatever worm we were during 2,500 years ago in Bodh Gaya when he attained enlightenment, and to becoming Buddhas ourselves. He's responsible. So that's important. So therefore, Tsongkhapa and Manjushri, in the Tsongkhapa embodiment and the Tsongkhapa deeds, they are kind of creating an extension of the Kali Yuga idea. So they're making the Dharma last for another 500 years and as a genuine Dharma, at least in one place on earth. I think in most of the places where Buddhism had been, right, it was already destroyed in India by this time, and there was stuff going on in East Asia. But, basically in East Asia, Buddhism was always only countercultural because the rulers and their militaries were always in charge and they never let it grow too much. They would purge it back when the monasteries got too popular and there was too much land devoted to the monks and too much free lunch. They didn't have the free lunch attitude like they did in India, in East Asia. If you know Confucius and things, the idea of somebody just dropping out to meditate and attain enlightenment, no way. It's not in the culture. It became in the culture from Buddhism, but it's not part of those cultures. So anyway, Dzongpa was born 1357, and when he's born, a man named Dunter Rinchen comes from central Tibet because he had a vision that an amazing child and probably a Manjushri kind of special emanation was going to be born way up in the sticks from central Tibet in Amdo, really on the border with China and Mongolia, in the Amdo province, and that he had a special mission to be his teacher, youthful teacher. And even he was told in a vision the name, he should give him Sumatikirti, Sanskrit name, Sumatikirti, meaning famous one of good heart. The famous good-hearted person is what Sumatikirti means. And Sumatikirti had been an important pandit and tantric teacher in Kashmir in the 10th, around the time of Tsongkhapa, and a great scholar of the Chakrasamvara Tantra and generally a great master. And he was to be given that name. Losam Drakpa in Tibetan is the translation of Sumatikirti, and which is one of Dalai Lama's names, right? You know the Dalai Lama mantra, right? Om Aum Vajraguru. Okay, so then if you look at the planetary, see, I'm telling you this because I see Tsongkhapa. I have the theory. I follow the theory of Rupert Sheldrake. I expand it. Of called morphogenetic resonance, that human beings are like a bunch of swans or geese, and that the patterns in our brains radiate by osmosis, morphogenetically, in others' brains, even without words, even without direct communication, which is now available in Western culture, in American culture, particularly since the 60s, in what we call vibes. Good vibes and bad vibes, you know, which we all know exist. We know that. In California, I think this is the land of good vibes, I hope, usually. And so, there's a planetary vibe, you know, and I attach that theory to the axial age of the time of Buddha when you had Confucius and Lao Tzu and you had the Upanishadic sages, and you had Isaiah who collected the Jewish Bible, and you had Socrates, the pre-Socratics, and then Socrates and Plato and so on, and Pythagoras, and so they're all same time, because there's a morphic resonance of like enlightenment, of human possibility of understanding the world is radiating there, which then gets covered up, of course, by institutions sooner or later. But I consider the Renaissance another one. And I think Tsongkhapa is a central figure in that. He's the Renaissance man of Tibet, but that radiates everywhere, I think. That's my theory. So that's why I'm locating in the planet. And the planet is, the Renaissance is starting in Europe because the Jewish and Muslim scholars are turning on the weirdo Europeans, getting out of their beer bottles and getting them to realize about the Greek knowledge, getting them away from the suppression of the church and be able to start science and everything. They're beginning that. You have the Ming Dynasty in China kind of reviving Buddhism, which had been oppressed under the Song Dynasty. And then the Mongols revived Tibetan Buddhism, but not so much Chinese Buddhism, when they were ruling in the Yuan Dynasty, and et cetera. There are sort of big renewals all over Eurasia, at least. You know, we never know how to connect the Americas and sub-Saharan Africa to these global movements, but I'm sure if we eventually someday we'll figure that out. And I don't think those things were as decadent as they are presented by European colonialists, personally, but that's another story. So anyway, the Renaissance is where worldwide, or at least Eurasia-wide, cultures are allowing brilliant individuals to arise who are beginning to see the greatness of the human embodiment. You all know, you've had your lamas here, you have your studies, you know where Lamrim begins after the relationship to the teacher. It begins with learning to appreciate yourself. Right, the precious jewel of a human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, which every single one of you has, and how that's where it starts, and your dharma practice does not start from you thinking how awful you are and you got to go do something to reform yourself. It starts from your thinking what a great opportunity. Sorry. Well, terrible with a mic. That's really bad. You can't mute this kind of mic. It starts with thinking what a wonderful mechanism you have. You don't need artificial intelligence. You have your own intelligence. They're just trying to imitate your brain, you know? You're way more intelligent than that. This is terrible. I'm going to blow my nose. I get very allergic. I have a little bit of allergic. I'm sorry. So that's where it begins. And the Renaissance begun by people have been in the Europe, crushed down by the church. You know, you can't really do anything, get anywhere. Anybody who was a mystic, if they had a vision of Christ or something, then they had to go flagellate themselves for a few weeks to make sure it wasn't Satan. People were totally suppressed. The scientists were arrested and burned at the stake or whatever. You know, it was terrible. And it was similarly, hierarchical institutions were terrorizing the populations all over Eurasia before the Renaissance. Then the ultimate terrorists, the Mongols, blasted Eurasia open, and knowledge and trade and diseases, unfortunately, also could go back and forth as they had in earlier times, and the Dark Ages were over. So that is what Tsongkhapa did. Tsongkhapa, it's a simultaneous thing. He went back to the great Axial Age teacher, that's Shakyamuni, and India kept that teaching alive without a Dark Age for 1,500 years, and the great Indian masters, the 3,600 great works in the Tengera, and many, many, many thousands more, actually, before the Muslims burned down the Buddhist monastic libraries in India. And so Tsongkhapa goes back to that, and at the same time he affirms our own ability to attain, which people had, oh, well, it's a Dark Age, you know, like, let's have a beer, you know. Oh, well, we can't really do it. It was like that idea of, like, you know, it's like in the West, the Republicans are waiting for the second coming before they're going to shape up. And because, you know, they can't behave like Jesus, imitatio Christi. They can't do like that because he's gone. He's not here. So, you know, the dark forces are out there. And so they're going to just arm themselves and go into their gated compounds. And then they might be trying to be spiritual when he shows up after killing everybody who doesn't agree with them. And that's the way people are when they think the founder is long gone. So what Tsongkhapa's whole movement is it's right here. Here's Shakyamuni. It's up to you to make use of the methods with which you can find your happiness. That's what it's about. That's what his greatness was, you know. And I'll show you in detail. And therefore, whether he's the main spark plug of it, which I think, but you could say Dogen in Japan, or, you know, you could say pick up anybody in the, you know, Petrarch, you know, Leonardo. You could pick anybody. And they're all resonating with each other. And they're saying, no, we humans can do something. We can find beauty. We can find enlightenment. We can understand the world. We don't have to be pushed around by a bunch of weird old bigoted, you know, Republican cardinals. So now, in Tibet, Khetrup Jay talks about, so therefore the worst thing there was the mass of men leading lives of quiet desperation, in Thoreau's famous phrase, in Tibet, by thinking that Dharma's kind of over, you know, and then different aristocratic warlords are fighting each other fairly frequently. There's no, once the Mongols left, there's no sort of single power in Tibet at this time, although the Kagyu myriarchs are the sort of strongest, but there's a bunch of them, and they occasionally conflict each other. And so that's the first thing. That's the obstacle that happened to Tsongkhapa as a sort of Renaissance man. And, you know, Mongol Empire and Sakya hegemony had collapsed. Kagyus were ascended in the 13 myriarchies. The Sakyas were still powerful scholastically. The Kadampas were marginalized. And the non-monastic Nyingmas were prevalent among the laity. And things were kind of, because Tibetans are very competitive, and when they're not unified around something, they tend to struggle, the lay people do, the aristocrats. Then women are, of course, still marginalized, and nuns are few and poor, and the full bhikshuni ordination never reached Tibet, was their excuse, and so they were only novices, and so that's always a bad thing in a society. Then the decay, but he doesn't mention that much, Khetrup, because he takes it, that's just the way it is, you know. The decay of, Khetrup mentions the decay of Vinaya monastic mendicant rule and practice was very much present and evident. And then one thing that he makes a big fuss about, there was a strong mutual contempt between the sort of yogi, not just Nyingma yogis, but any yogis, who were like not into scholastics. They may have had a sort of undergraduate education as a scholastic, but they were really into caves and long meditations and things like that. And the scholastics ones who were lifelong monastics in the monastic colleges. And this connected to a sense of someone, if they were a very strong philosopher in the Sutrayana or the Prajnaparamita level of study, or the what they call, you know, the philosophical study, they thought Tantra was kind of crazy. And the tantrics thought that the people doing the texts were crazy, and that it was, you know, you did one or the other or something. They had an attitude like that, which was going on at the time Tsongkhapa came on the scene. And within Tantra, importantly, and this you find very much addressed by Tsongkhapa in his Ngagrim Chemo, his great stages of the mantric path, where a lot of even the yogi and tantric practitioners were disgusted with what's called the creation stage. I think you mostly know it as generation stage. In other words, the visualizing and the ritual and the making of the mandala, that sort of part. And the more people wanted to get right into sort of Dzogchen or Mahamudra or jump straight into Shunyata or have the magic body or have a rainbow body. I mean, they had no patience. What is this? I have to sit and memorize the architecture of a mandala palace with like 200 beams going around and this kind of floor and those kind of ornaments on the wall and 32 other deities inside sitting on lotus cushions and et cetera, blah, blah, blah. It's a tremendous amount of detail. And then my own body, you know, I have like 24 arms and my fingers are painted different colors, et cetera, et cetera. So the people were very impatient with all of that. And they were thinking, people who do that, they're just like just a bunch of mumbo-jumbo people. And I'm going straight into it, you know, just sky yoga, you know, that kind of thing. And that was a big problem, actually, because you can't really do the sky yoga well unless you've already reconstructed the world imaginatively in some way. So these were the big obstacles that he confronted. And now in the context of those, Tsongkhapa himself, by his mid-20s, actually he was initiated in the Yamantaka Mandala at the age of 4, around the time he was made a monk. And he did a retreat and was given what's called the self-initiation at 7. And it said he did a short version of the self-initiation every day all of his life since then, especially of Yamantaka, which relates very much with Manjushri. And it's like Guhya Samaja otherwise, very similar, but it's Guhya Samaja in a kind of a monster suit or something like that, you could say. But it's otherwise really similar. It's a father tantra, and it's like Guhya Samaja. And so he was a prodigy, and he naturally learned to read. They didn't have to teach him, etc. So he was a child prodigy. But still, by mid-20s, he was writing his own amazing works. He was matchless in debate. He had had experiences that were known by people, like in one Sakya monastery when they were reading logic, you know, Pramana, Dick Dharmakirti's work. He went into trance for 3 days, and they did that. He was so intense and so quiet that they decided to leave him, and he stayed for 2 or 3 days till someone finally said, "You better go have a bite." And so he was sort of really known as highly attained already in his mid-20s, and mastering, you know, memorizing and mastering everything, you know. But then a funny thing happened to him. There was a lama called Umapa, who was also Eastern Tibetan from Amdo, and a real hayseed. He was illiterate. He was a yak herder. And one day he was out in the field tending his yaks, and he heard a sound like a freight train going by, which of course, he didn't know what a freight train was. But, you know, a roaring sound like that, and he passed out. And when he woke up, Manjushri was there in his little bubble ship, you know, and started talking to him. And he was always present to him from then on, forever, in his life, this Umapa. So then Manjushri said, "Now that you're a medium of mine, you go to such and such a monastery, you know, hand the axe back to your relatives, you go to such and such monasteries, you learn to read and write, you study basic books, blah, blah, blah." Then after he did that for a while, he said, "Now you go to central Tibet, you go find Tsongkhapa. I want you to be my channel to teach Tsongkhapa," and which he did that. And so he showed up in the monasteries, and he was a monk. He had become a monk by then. But he was kind of, you know, like a hayseed kind of, they felt, to central Tibetans. But not Tsongkhapa. Tsongkhapa immediately loved him. It was like Rumi and Shamsi Tabriz. It was like he was a mystic partner of Tsongkhapa. And Dzongpa pretty got wind of the fact that he could consult directly with Manjushri. And he couldn't see Manjushri himself, Dzongpa, at that time, but he got wind that Umapa could. And so then he went off, he started going off with Umapa in little retreats, and he would ask Umapa questions, who would then ask Manjushri, and then give him the answers. And this went on for some time. And it was created a kind of uproar in the Dzongpa circle of teachers and fellow students that in his 20s, he'd already written, as I say, this book. He was almost coming up in almost 30, and he was highly sought after as a teacher already. And then he kept disappearing and going off with Umapa. And so they thought he was going astray. His own teacher, Rendawa, who was a Sakyapa, was saying, "Why are you hanging out with that guy? You should start teaching now. It's your job," and blah, blah. And he said, "Well, no, I want to ask Manjushri more things, you know." And he felt, in other words, he sort of had to, he felt that none of his teachers could quite give him everything that he wanted to learn. And Manjushri somehow was there at the moment, you know. And then finally Manjushri said to him, got annoyed with him, and Manjushri used to scold him. Then Umapa said, "Well, I can't stay with you forever. And also it upsets all your friends and the people. So I probably will have to leave," Manjushri tells me. "So before that, I have to teach you how you can see him yourself." And he gives him some teachings, and he does a little retreat and meditating. And then actually he can see Manjushri himself, and he starts asking questions directly. And then basically Umapa goes home, goes back to the east after a while. And then Manjushri starts scolding Dzongpa, of course. And he says, finally he gets really fed up with him, and he says, "You know, how's your Madhyamaka view?" And Dzongpa says, "Well, I think that's coming along." And, "No, it isn't. You know, you're just nihilist. You know, you just think when your mind is vacant and you don't have anything, you're not thinking anything, you think that's emptiness. And it isn't. And you're just like, come on, you're like a worse nihilist, you know." And he says, "Your special job, even in this incarnation, is to take care of relative reality and the refined complexities of dealing with the compassion side in relative reality and interacting with people. Absolute reality is easy for you, but now you're still just a nihilist. So you neither reality have you got straightened out. Well, then tell me some more." He said, "No, I already told you everything, and you already know everything, actually, but you don't know what you know because you're still impure. You have some impurities. You have to go on a 5-year retreat." "Oh, no, we can't do that." And even Umapa protests. He's like, "Everyone wants him to teach. They'll all be mad and blah, blah, blah. I don't care what they want. I know what's going to be effective and you don't. He's got to go on a retreat and deepen this or it won't be that great." And then he tells him, "Pick 8 associates and go." And so he does. And he goes to a place called Olka. Well, I went there, actually. Marvelous place in central Tibet. And it's a really great place. And then he has a 5-year retreat. And in the 5-year retreat, not with Umapa. Umapa has left before that, but he has these eight fellow disciples who they all do all this retreating stuff. And Dzongpa, he does 35 sets of 100,000 prostrations to the 35 Buddhas of purification, for example. He takes with him the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Hua Yan Jing, you know, for Chinese, you know, the Flower Ornament Sutra, Tom Cleary's translation. I hope people know that, although I know you're studying Tibetan, but that's so amazing. That English translation called Flower Ornament Sutra, Hua Yan Jing, very famous in China. Of course, it's Indian sutra, but amazing sutra. And he takes that sutra, he takes his Madhyamaka books, he takes his tantric books, especially Guhya Samaja, but all of them, he takes them. And he studies Guhya Samaja, perfection stage, creation stage stuff, along with sutra, Madhyamaka, Prajnaparamita type study. He studies this together, you know. That's one thing that people don't really recognize. He's not just, because he doesn't always mention the tantric side unless he's writing about tantra, but he is always doing them together because they fit together, actually.
If you are not yet aware, poet, translator, painter, publisher Lawrence Ferlinghetti is the first poet read by millions in his own lifetime. In his autobiography, an important moment was as a Navy officer being sent to Nagasaki after the bomb. He writes, "It really made me an instant pacifist. Up to that time, I'd been a good American boy, in the Boy Scouts, etc. Nagasaki really woke me up." He's also the founder of the first bookstore in America dedicated to paperbacks, City Lights, which pioneered the homey library atmosphere now used by chain book outlets. City Lights Publishing Company was a major vehicle for the Beats, made famous during the obscenity trial over a book by Allen Ginsberg, and continues to remain a contemporary, vital publishing house in America. A biography of Ferlinghetti is available by fellow poet Neely Tchaikovsky. This is a short poem, although he's given to long poems, to his friend, the elder statesman of the Bohemian era of his time and ours, Kenneth Rexroth, who lived in Santa Barbara. At Kenneth Rexroth's, "Sweet William Blake in a book in Santa Barbara echoes in the eucalyptus. I roll 7 chopsticks together, and in their clicking hear the sound of last summer's cicadas. I look westward into the end of day, the last frontier still made of water." I'm Gary Gawk, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.